Mr. Fine, Real 11. We were talking about the V-Day celebrations, quite lively that you had, and you were saying you were put in the cells overnight. We were interrupted. What happened next morning?
Well, a very serious but friendly sergeant, and I, as far as I remember, woke me up with a cup of tea. I would think from memory it was roughly about 6:30 in the morning. The state of my head I cannot remember, but from the amount I had consumed, I would imagine it was pretty ropey. We did stagger back on board the ship. I was back on before 0730, so I didn't get put in a rattle for being adrift. To all intents and purposes, I suppose you could say my war as regards risk was finished. We were being fitted out in Belfast for going to the Far East. They were...
Now, what was that refit like?
They were removing single organs from memory and putting on twin power-operating organs, if my memory serves me. In other words, you had two foot pedals, a left and a right. You could swing the guns left or right on by power. They were twin organs, which made them quite a powerful gun. Other armaments and such, I cannot remember. I presume, and I could be wrong, the depth charges were being removed, but I don't remember.
What was it? The ship, was it changing its function?
Well, it was going to be, they were fitting onto the ship a lot of RT radio telephones, because as far as we were given to understand, and that was why we were being fitted with so much anti-aircraft stuff, we were going to be anchored off any point of invasion of Japan, controlling landing craft going ashore. Obviously, being anchored there, we would have been sitting ducks for kamikaze or any sort of Japanese bombers, but I'm delighted to say, and I suppose I'm being very selfish, that they dropped a D-bomb, which I think you all know what I'm referring to, and the whole thing stopped overnight. I can very, very clearly remember a great deal of excitement. I don't remember it in detail.
Were there any celebrations?
There were celebrations. I cannot remember them in detail. Truthfully, it was all a celebration. I suppose if one looks at it dispassionately, once it had survived and was going to survive, which I suppose is as good a way as anything.
So what was shipboard routine like? Were you just in harbour?
We were in Belfast on Pollock Dock. To a certain extent, routine carried on. I cannot remember. I think things were moderately slack, although there was obviously a certain amount of naval discipline, which goes without saying. But I can remember very clearly being told and falling in on the jetty by the ship in August of 1945, and that was my finish with the Calder. I was falling in with loads of other of the fellows. There was purely a skeleton crew left on board, and we were then sent back to our respective depots.
How did you feel about leaving a ship you'd been with for a couple of years? And the crew?
In retrospect, I suppose now, because it was such a friendly and happy ship, and had so many years, I'm sad. At the age of 23, 24, you don't feel those emotions. It's something that passed. I can't honestly say I remember feeling sad in any shape or form. I might have done, but it would be telling lies if you asked me to specify completely. I cannot truly remember my feelings. And then in retrospect, I probably was sorry.
Now, where did you go to? Which was your...
I went back to Chatham Barracks. As I said, we did leave a skeleton crew on board, and I do know, because it's documented history, that in October of that year, the Calder went back to America because it was leased, it was being returned, and it went partnership with another one of our ships, HMS Essington, and there is a picture taken by a newspaper, and I have the picture, stern view on of two dirty, very miserable looking ships tied up in Brooklyn, maybe Ali Heights, my memory says exactly. I suppose, once again, in retrospect, one looks at them and realises that they're the sad sights. That is virtually the end of that part of my naval life. I went back to barracks, normal leave. I was then, came back, drafting office called for me, and I was told that I was going on a course. Like most arms of the service, there's not much for you to do, they sent you on courses.
And when was this? September?
This would have been September time, I can't pin a date. When I'd gone into the Navy, and first gone into RDF as it was known, it then subsequently became radar, and at the latter end of the war, radar was divided up, I think I'm right in saying, into two sections, radar plot and radar gunnery, RP and RG. Each rating, no, let me rephrase, each level of rating was numbered. You had an RP3, an RP2, and an RP1, that was up the scale, and in other words, an RP1, I think, was a chief PO. I was being sent, I was classified for those purposes as an RP3, although obviously I had quite a bit of experience. And I was being sent on an RP2's course.
So a radar plot course?
Yeah, an RP2's course, radar plot 2.
And where were you sent to?
I returned to my old stamping ground where I'd done my original RDF course at the Isle of Man, Douglas Head. There is an amusing episode that I can relate. As we were going to then become RP2s and leading seamen, we had to be capable of marching and taking a squad of men. The parade ground was the roadway in front of the hotel that was all barbed wire off right on the front. We had a PO instructor who, to put it in plain English, had never heard the sound of an angry shot. I don't think he'd ever been to sea, he'd got his feet wet. But he'd obviously passed out quite hires when he first took the course, and they made him up to a PO instructor. I suppose I'm being a bit sarcastic there. I think he was more frightened, in fact I'm sure he was more frightened of us than we were of him, because we'd all done quite a lot of time at sea, and I suppose if one thinks about it here, we treated him with a certain amount of contempt. He asked us to step forward and take the squad in turn to drill us and march us, and it was my turn to do it. I was pulled out the front, and they started marching the boys up and down. And they were marching towards the barbed wire in Glasgow. And I realised that I had to give them the order for about turn. My mind completely went blank, and I didn't know on which foot to give the order about turn. I was marching at the left-hand rear of the column, quite near the last fellow, and I came in and said, "For Christ's sake, stop us, we're going in the bloody wire." And all I could say, "Oh, for Christ's sake, halt!" Well, I can tell you, the PO wet himself laughing, and so did all the chaps. An amusing incident. When we finished...
What sort of course was it? Do you remember any other aspects of the course, taking drill?
Oh, it was general RP course. I can't remember the details.
Was there anything new, much new? That you
No, it was actually old because they were training us on British stuff. We do, and having been on the course, which was all American, we had to relearn things all over again. Obviously, the sets, the British sets I was trained on originally way back in 1941,
Had they changed much?
They're advanced. Although, in my opinion, they hadn't advanced as much as the Americans had. But it was more to do with height finding and general approach work, plotting. And there was much more of the plotting, because plotting had hardly been considered in the early part of the war.
What was radar plotting? If you just explain it briefly for
us. You had a plot table working with a radar set. When a contact was made by radar, it was a certain distance, range, and at a certain degree angle from the ship. That distance and angle was plotted on a chart table. As the object you were reporting moved one way or the other, you put the new range and bearing, and over a period of time, and then traveled X in Y number of minutes, you could work out its speed relationship here. That is the basic principle of plotting. You also, as it happens on the Calder, we worked very closely with the ASDIC people of the underwater sound, and we did the plotting for them of U-boats moving about underwater. Plotting in its latter days became very important. Today, I don't know, maybe it's plotting all the time.
Anything else about the course?
Yeah. We then went to the second half of the course, which was down at Yeovilton. This was a fleet air arm station, which it is still a fleet air arm station today. We were not actually stationed on the camp, on the aerodrome. We were just on the outside in Nissen Huts. It was November by then, and it was bitter bloody cold.
So it was quite a long course.
Oh yeah, it was about 3 or 4 weeks. And then there was breaks in between, you know. And the main thing there was the height finding with the aircraft taking off. And the RT work, because we did a lot of RT.
Radio telephony.
They were training fleet air arm pilots. Although the war was over, the call, they were still carrying on training. These things didn't stop overnight, as you can imagine. And we were doing RT with these pilots, which is something we would be doing anyway, because we were able to do that sort of thing. We had exams, and it so happens, and I will put it no more pointedly, and I was very friendly with a wing in the captain's office. We were passing out on a Saturday morning, and we were being mustered, or going to be mustered, in a very large hangar. And we had a big dance party, had danced the night before. I was dancing with his men, and chatting away, and working the captain's office. He obviously knew quite a few things. And he said, "Oh, you've done very well in your exams." Well, it wasn't for design. I mean, it was... We'd done the work over and over and over again, it was almost second nature. So I said, "Well, what do you mean?" "Oh," she said, "you've passed out not for RP2, but they're going to offer you RP1 status." Well, that was the chief PO. I thought, "Well, this is," I must say, my ego was very, well, I'm very pleased with myself. The fact that I was being offered to go from AB to CPO. And I said, "Well, how does it go?" She said, and I can remember the figure of her being, You've got 92.5% pass mark. Well, I suppose in anybody's language that's pretty high. And when I'm chatting, I got very excited. I said, well, do you realise that if you accept it, you'll be have to stay in the Navy longer? Well, my heart sunk, as you can imagine, and I knew then that my age and service group was number 48. Although it wasn't by any chance immediate demob, it was on the horizon. This was then, I suppose, the length of course we had leave in between this, that and the other. It was about the middle of December by then, but I can't remember exactly, it was too long ago. So I said, well, what do you mean? Oh, she said, they are very, one of the reasons they're offering you this and one or two others, not just me, not myself, but most important, they're desperately short of cheap POs for carriers, battleships and heavy cruisers. You will be in charge of the radar office under the officer. So I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, they'll ask you to stay on for at least 2 years. Well, I was not happy about that, to say the least. And I said to her, well, I don't want to. She said, well, the only way you can do it is you. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, when you're called up in front of him, he'll give you a whole spiel. Say, and I completely said, she said, declined advancement. But with great fear and trepidation, I didn't sleep much that night, worrying about what the reaction was going to be after all. This was a four-ring RN captain who was known by repute as a very bad-tempered man. I've never come across him. And the Master of Arms read out my name and number and said to him, march forward, read out the exam results. And this captain, obviously, had the records from his Master of Arms. You've done a good job, lad, you served your country, and the usual claptrap. You were going, I said, excuse me, sir. Yes? I said, declined advancement. Well, for the moment, I thought the roof of the hangar was going to take off. He said, turned to the Master of Arms, and he said to him, Master of Arms, get this fucking man out of my sight! I was double the brain very smartly, and that was a Saturday morning. And on Saturday afternoon, I was already on the train back to Chatham Barracks. I then.
So you never got your leading seamen's either? You got nothing?
I should tell you that prior to going on to the course, there was a cock-up and I was drafted for a limited period. I think it was about 4 or 6 weeks to HMS Bologna, which was a 525 cruiser in Chatham Dockyard. It was one of those naval cock-ups whereby I was on the draft to the course, the radar course. Somebody had crossed wire somewhere. I was then drafted to the Bologna. Go on board the Bologna, a bag and hammock. Nobody knows anything about me. The radar officer is called, and I'm standing there like a lemon of the gangway. Anyways, there was a draft. There's a draft in here. You've got the draft here. I don't know about. I don't need a radar or anything anyway. I had a bit of a bumpy ride because it didn't want me. And I got off on me whenever I could. And eventually I got a modern day pass and a bit pissed off. Took the opportunity to go back to the drafting office in Chatham. And as I walked in there, one of the POs sitting there, I knew quite well, I can't remember from where now, said, we want you. We're just about to send the police to your home. You're AWOL. So I said, well, He said, well, you were St. Tommy's Cross 8 weeks ago. I said, well, oh, usual screw up. He phoned the quartermaster at the on the Bologna. He sent me back very quickly to pack my bag and hammock. I reported to the radar officer. He said, well, he said, I'll say cheerio to you, he said, but I never had you never really wanted my crew because I didn't need you. Good luck. And I was gone. And that's when I went back to the drafting office. I got another few days leave. I think it was a week, but I can't remember now. And that's when I went on the course.
Now, what happened when you got back from the course?
Well, then I was given odd jobs hanging around Chatham Barracks because I was then in the stream of demand. My number was scheduled.
So that would be from December.
Well, I got Christmas leave, that I remember. I think it was the first Christmas leave I'd had in the years I'd been in, because it was, first of all, it was Christmas leave, and second of all, the war was finished, and as I said before, I had survived, and when
was it a special leave? I mean, did you enjoy it, or...?
As I say, I'd survived, it was a Christmas leave, it was something. The war was over, there was that atmosphere of peace. One didn't know too closely what had gone on in other parts of the world. These things came to light a long time later, unless you were directly involved in it. I wasn't at that time. I worked in various offices, doing clerical work in and around the DevOps Centre.
So clerical duties?
Clerical duties, yes. Well, clerical, mainly clerical duties, checking in stores and things, you know, anything. I mean, there was one time I know I was sent for a week to check in gas masks, checking them off a list. And, I mean, absolute rubbish, filling in time, that's what it was. Like so many of the things in the forces.
And when were you demobilised?
I can tell you that very clearly, time and date. I was immobilised at 09:05 hours on the 2nd of April, 1946.
And what was the demobilisation procedure for you?
Well, having worked in the DevOps Centre, obviously I had friends in various parts of the DevOps. I never actually worked in the DevOps office where the papers were. But I had worked in the clothing department. One of the fellows on the mess deck in with the mob centre, that was in the special section, was actually working in the DeMob office where the papers were. And as luck would have it, he was the same age of service group as me, and we'd come up on the same day. So we had a little arrangement. I got him, because I was working that day, a very nice suit and clothing, which was boxed up in the store with his name on it. And obviously I knew the people there and said, this is for XYZ when he came through. And he got my papers under his on that morning. So we were lining up long before, I mean, I can't remember how early, but excitement was on beyond belief. I don't know if it was a slept by slept night. And obviously the office started at 9 o'clock. He was the first papers through, and mine were the second papers through. You know, it was just a go bang, bang, bang. And of course, I went in and I said to the bloke who I'm doing this, and he got the clothes off. This is that. Obviously, I've got to say, my stuff was already in the box, and we were out of those gates, quicker than our little flat feet could carry us.
Did you get a good suit for yourself as well?
I got quite a nice sports jacket. I can't remember what the trousers were, but I had a project which I had for quite a long time. I'll show you a picture of it if you want to. Not really interested, but I can actually. Anyway, it was quite a nice sports jacket.
Now, what were you to do? You'd come out.
Well, can I just tell you one little story on the way home about this bloke? I can't remember his name, but I think he came from the northeast somewhere. We're on the train. On Gillingham, because there was two stations, Gillingham and Chatham, we came out of Gillingham. maybe the old-fashioned carriages with a leather strap that pulled down and the window dropped. And he and I were the only two in the compartment. This was then probably all before 10 o'clock. Or then, you know, the cab was pretty empty. And he said, "I'm going home in civvies." So I said, "What are you going to do with your uniform?" And I come back and he was like, "I'll show you what I'm going to do with it." He changed in the compartment down to his underclothes. And he said, "I don't want this ABC uniform anymore. I'm going to throw it away." I said, "But your name?" Oh, he said, "Don't worry." He took his knife and cut all his names out. And I think I could have dropped the window. And he took his sailor's hat out. And this was a flat Cape countryside we were going through, just not the far out of Gillingham. I said, "He'd take his hat by the wind and whirl it." And it flew across the countryside. I can still see it flying now. It landed in the field somewhere, I don't know. And his clothes went after him. After him. He cut all the names out so they could never trace him, I presume. We said goodbye. This was London Bridge. I never saw him again, and he's never seen me again.
And you didn't throw your uniform?
No, I kept mine, although my wife made sure that when we got divorced some years later, she burnt a lot.
Now, what about, what were you to do when you came out? You'd been in so long.
Well, I had a job to go back to because they were obliged to give you a job. But they were not obliged to give you the exact job you were. If you'd been counting screws or nuts and bolts, they were not obliged to give you the same job.
So what did they give you when you went back?
They gave me a job selling a commodity which I was not at all happy with. I was very unhappy with it. I suppose the discipline in the Navy had sort of, I don't know, maybe, I suppose to have the discipline again in civil life, I revolted at it. The man in charge of this department was an elderly man, very dogmatic and bombastic. And I lost my temper completely on an occasion 4 or 5 weeks, maybe 6 weeks afterwards, in his office, pulled the telephone out by his cord and threw it at him. Luckily, he stayed in there, and I told him in plain English what to do with his job. It's a long story, but I won't go into it. I very nearly went back into the horses.
What made you think of that?
Well, there was a friend of mine in the Royal Army Ordnance Corps who was a W01, had come back from the Far East, gone in as a private in 1939, come back as a very senior top warrant officer, was in the ROC, and it appears he was still in, he hadn't been demobbed yet. He was stationed at Felton Middlesex, a big ROC depot. And he told me one day, he said, "We've had a signal." Well, it was the brigadier who was in charge of the brigadier. "Collect, get any servicemen, either Army, Navy, or to join the RAOC. They would immediately be on a course. They would get there. They would pass out as lieutenants. With very, very quick promotion. You had to sign, you'd go overseas. And they guaranteed that within 5 years you'd be a major, if you were prepared to stay on."